On this week's 51%, find out how to steer clear of raising mean girls.
Putting them together in a room, they really will start to talk about things, and they'll start to really get to know other people on a deeper level, which is really, really important.
Hear about removing firearms from homes in cases of domestic violence, and meet the illustrator behind a comic strip and book series. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Do you ever go to lunch with no one by your side? 'Cause the moment you arrive, they'll leave the table. Calling me everything but my name, need I remind you again? Just call me Rachel. How would you feel if you're running home crying like yourself in your room? Don't want anyone to see ya while everyone's having fun outside and you're telling yourself.
According to the National Bullying Prevention Center, 23% of female students in the United States report being bullied by their peers. While that figure is only slightly higher than the 19% of male students who report being bullied, there is a significant difference in the type of bullying reported among girls and boys. Boys are more likely to report physical aggression, and girls are more likely to report incidences of relational aggression, aka mean girls. The 2004 film of the same name, starring Lindsay Lohan, Rachel McAdams, and Tina Fey, shined a spotlight on this form of bullying. Clinical social worker Katie Hurley says that today, girls as young as 3 years old are experiencing relational aggression, and it can leave lasting emotional scars. In her new book, No More Mean Girls: The Secret to Raising Strong, Confident, and Passionate Girls, she discusses the consequences of relational aggression and how parents in today's society can help prevent it. 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall recently spoke with Hurley about her book and the concept of the mean girl.
Okay, you should just know that we don't do this a lot, so this is like a really huge deal.
We want to invite you to have lunch with us every day for the rest of the week.
Oh, it's okay.
Coolness. So we'll see you tomorrow. On Wednesdays, we wear pink.
What exactly is a mean girl? What's the definition?
You know, mean girl is something that has sort of evolved over time and, as we know, became popular with the movie Mean Girls, which in a way did us all a favor because it took the face of relational aggression, which people for years and years just sort of said, oh, that's just what girls do, or that's girl drama, and sort of watered it down, and they took it and put it right into the spotlight and said, no, this thing that girls are doing to each other is really, really damaging. And so basically it's a girl who engages in what we call relational aggression, which means intentionally trying to damage the reputation of another person. So it's not someone who engages in physical aggression so much, but tries to spread gossip, rumors, exclude certain girls, all these kinds of behaviors, public humiliation that get other kids laughing at them and that make other girls feel really isolated and left out.
Where does this behavior come from?
Low self-esteem is a large driving factor of this behavior. When I work with the girls who are the so-called mean girls, almost every single one of them really struggles with their self-esteem. And so what they do is to get on top and to feel good about themselves momentarily or for a small portion of time, they sort of try to take down other girls in their wake. But the other problem we're having right now is that girls are facing high levels of toxic competition. They're being thrown into these competitive environments at a very, very young age before they're developmentally prepared to do so emotionally. And they're being pounded with achievement pressure. So they're being told to succeed, to be the best ones, to score the most goals, you know, to be the best artists, the best writers, et cetera. So they're constantly under this pressure and stress. And as a result, they're really turning on each other at younger ages.
Now, how does that differ from how boys handle it? Are boys thrust into the same situation?
One thing we are seeing is that boys are starting to engage in more of this relational aggression behavior that they didn't used to do so much. It used to be more physical when boys would bully. But one thing about boys is that while they do sometimes tease one another and bully one another, what does happen is that they sort of come back to each other pretty quickly. Like they forgive easily and move on until it happens again, where girls get very emotionally invested in their friendships. And so these behaviors are very damaging for them.
Now, how young are we talking about here? I know one of the points in your book is that these girls are quite young, a lot younger than we would have expected.
20 years ago, when I first started out in this business, it was high school and maybe the older end of middle school. And now we're seeing these behaviors as young as kindergarten and first grade. And there are even some cases where it starts to manifest in preschool, though I'm always careful to say, at those younger ages, the preschool, kindergarten, first grade, these are girls who do not have well-honed social skills and really need help figuring out how to relate to other kids. And we're living in a time where we don't take the time to teach those skills to kids anymore, and also where those youngest children are pretty play-deprived. And that's where kids learn how to get through this stuff and how to cope. What we see then typically is a lot of the either exclusion or the threats. So I'm not going to play with you at recess unless you do A, B, and C. Or if you don't do this, I'm going to tell the teacher right away. Or you go sit over there on that rock and maybe we'll let you play in a little bit. These are the kinds of things first, second graders are engaging in.
You talk about emotional scars that kids take away from these experiences. What kind of emotional scars does this type of bullying leave?
Well, for one thing, it triggers anxiety. So I'm talking about actual anxiety where kids are having trouble sleeping at night and having trouble getting to school every day and not feeling well, you know, getting stomach aches and headaches a lot of the time. It also can trigger symptoms of depression. And what we find is that if these kids, you know, even if the bullying stops, if the kids who were victims don't get proper treatment from a therapist to work through their feelings and the things that happened along the way, then later on in adolescence, they're at risk for anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and even suicidal ideation.
Now, in your book, you discuss things like strategies on how to form friendships, skills to build healthy relationships, ways to acquire healthy self-esteem. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that, aspect of how you treat girls who are, you know, feeling the pain from these relationships?
One thing I do out in Los Angeles is I run empowerment groups for girls, and they're not therapy groups. They're just groups for girls to come together and think about these things and talk about these things, like what does it mean to have healthy self-esteem, and what do you do when you feel bad about yourself, and how can you tap into your strengths? And what I find is that I have 20 girls in a room who've never met, and within 15 minutes, they're sharing stories, they're listening to each other, they're empathizing with each other, they're talking. So one really important thing that communities can do is offer these sort of non-competitive group environments for girls. And I'm always encouraging parents to start things like either a mother-daughter book club or an art club in their town. Getting girls together in groups where they just can relate and hang out and talk and be girls without the pressure of performing, without the pressure of succeeding, because putting them together in a room, they really will start to talk about things and they'll start to really get to know other people on a deeper level, which is really, really important. You know, and then I'm always talking to parents about one thing that comes up a lot with girls is because they spend so much time at school, you know, they're 6.5 hours a day in a classroom. Those friends in their classroom become like their lifeblood. They become almost obsessed with those few people that they encounter all day long every day. And sometimes those friendships are great, but sometimes they're not. So I encourage parents to just draw little friendship maps with their girls and talk about, you know, draw all the places they go and spend time, you know, whether it's a soccer team or a ballet class or a church or a temple or, you know, some other religious organization where they spend some time on the weekends, and name the friends that are there, draw those people into it, and then take a step back and look at it and say, geez, you know, you're really good at making friends. It seems like you have a lot of friends in a lot of different places, and try to really connect those friendships a little more and build those bonds so that girls feel like I'm not alone just because things aren't working out at school right now.
Is there anything else besides what you suggested that parents might be able to do?
I love having parents do strengths boards with their girls. So I like to get girls really thinking about what are their strengths so that when someone says to them, hey, what do you do well? Or what is it you like to do? They horseback riding, you know, they get it right out there. So getting a large poster board and decorating it however they want, you know, whatever the theme of their room is, however they like it to look, and then just having them draw in giant bubble letters, the things that they love to do, the things that they feel good about themselves when they're doing it. So it can be anything like riding a bike. You know, it can be collecting sea glass on the beach. It could be soccer. It can be volleyball. It can be, you know, writing. I like to write stories. I like to read books. Just put all those strengths up on one board and hang it in their room so that they're constantly seeing it. So it just gets them more in touch with who they are and what makes them unique.
That's a great exercise. Do these same sorts of techniques work for older girls or even adults who may need to deal with some of these similar issues in their own social circles?
Yeah, they absolutely do. And you know, I work with a lot of teen girls, and it is very difficult to be a teen girl right now. I always have teen girls. I'll ask them to think of mantras, you know, things that they just power thoughts that will get them through the day, like, I'm a good friend, I can read when I feel stressed. I can, you know, I talk to mom when I'm upset, blah, blah, blah. And just put these like mantras on different pieces of paper and tape them all over their wall just to help them remind them that A, they have support everywhere they go, and B, that they're, you know, great people and they have great things to offer the world. And those kind of things work well with teens. I also encourage parents all the time. I encourage parents to do, you know, mother-daughter or parent-daughter, depending on what the family looks like, journals where, you know, a tween or teen can write a note to mom or dad at night before bed in a little journal. It's just a safe place to get things out without feeling like you're being stared at, without feeling like you're being watched or like someone's going to judge you for what you're saying, because girls kind of go through this period where they have a difficult time getting their feelings out. So they write a little note at night, and then the next day mom or dad reads it and writes a note back, and you just have sort of a daily note back and forth. And sometimes it may be hard stuff. Your teen might start confiding hard stuff that she's going through, and other times she might be okay. So you're just writing back and forth what you did today, or something funny you saw, or something interesting you saw that you thought she would like to know about. And that's a really good connection tool, especially for older girls when it's really hard to come forward and say, hey, I have no friends and I'm struggling.
That was licensed clinical social worker Katie Hurley speaking with 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Hurley's new book is No More Mean Girls: The Secret to Raising Strong, Confident, and Passionate Girls. Governor Andrew Cuomo wants to give police officers in New York the legal power to remove firearms from a home after a case of domestic violence. Currently, firearms must be surrendered by someone charged with domestic violence only if the suspect is named in an order of protection, or if a judge decides the accused poses a threat to the protected person. The measure has the support of Amy Barash, who served as executive director for the New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence and is now executive director of the New York City-based group Her Justice. She spoke with 51%'s Brian Shields.
We're a nonprofit. We're actually celebrating our 25th year in existence, and we are working in New York City to stand with women living in poverty by training and mentoring volunteer attorneys to help these women with their individual legal needs as well as address systemic legal challenges.
Governor Cuomo, in his state budget, called for a new law that will allow police officers to seize guns in cases of a person charged with domestic abuse, if there are guns in the household, and this person who's been charged owns those guns. There's a similar law under consideration in Vermont, but a lawmaker there wants to give that power only to judges. He's afraid of the constitutionality of allowing police to seize weapons that are not actually evidence in a criminal case. The constitutionality of this, is it clear?
I think that there are a lot of circumstances in which it's constitutionally permissible for law enforcement to take guns at scenes of crimes generally and in domestic violence cases in particular. In fact, that can happen now without a change in the law. And I think I really commend the governor for supporting ways in which to ensure surrender of firearms in domestic violence situations, because we know a lot of research shows that, you know, victims of domestic violence are much more likely to die, to be killed by a firearm if there is a firearm in the home, obviously. We also know that a firearm in the home is correlated with exacerbated violence overall. So I think his interest in increasing the times when we surrender weapons at these scenes makes a lot of sense. I would suggest that a place where we can look more for this work now, even before any legislation passes the New York State Legislature, which passes things with all deliberate speed typically, is to really look at the family court scenario. Typically, the law allows for surrender of firearms in two circumstances in domestic violence, either conviction of a qualifying misdemeanor or at the issuance of an order of protection. And as I'm sure you know, orders of protection can be issued in criminal or family court. When they're issued in family court, those orders are served, delivered to the accused individual by sheriffs. And at that moment in time, if ordered by the judge or given other circumstances occasionally, sheriffs can remove firearms at that time. And I think that would be something we could do now. And we all of us who work in this system, whether civil attorneys like myself and my agency or advocates, law enforcement, judges, everybody could be thinking about appropriate circumstances to get guns out of the home.
Why are some of these cases going to family court? If a person is assaulted, isn't that a criminal offense?
It absolutely can be, but in New York, we have options. Victims can go to either or both places for some charges. And a lot of victims of domestic violence choose to go to family court for a couple of reasons. First of all, they may not want to call the police. They may not want to have their partner or the other parent of their children arrested. They may be uncomfortable participating in law enforcement for a whole host of reasons. Maybe they're afraid of retribution. Maybe they're in a questionable documentation status as a foreign-born individual. They don't want to engage with the police, but they really need that order of protection to reduce the violence in the home. So we have an opportunity in New York State for people to go to family court and get the same kind of order of protection, same force and power that you would have if you got an order out of criminal court.
How effective are orders of protection? It's really just a piece of paper unless it's enforced.
Exactly right. I mean, orders of protection have been shown to be very powerful in changing behavior. But a lot of people will say, for example, an order of protection is just a piece of paper. It can't stop a bullet. And that's exactly why we should be having offenders surrender their firearms when they are subject to an order of protection, because the order of protection can change other behavior. But if you have an armed individual and they're intent on using that firearm, there's very little that is going to stop them.
How long is an order of protection usually in effect? I've heard the complaint that a person is arrested for domestic violence. They're out in 48 to 72 hours, perhaps even shorter if they make bail quickly. So how effective are these orders to keep an abuser away from a home?
Well, the order of protection, as you said, is only as effective as its enforcement. And that enforcement really has to be kind of a collaborative effort. So it's on the victim to call the police if they see the offender coming near them. But the more information law enforcement has, the better able they are. They're better able to enforce the orders of protection. So, for example, they did a pilot in California where even after they had a law such as the law that the governor is recommending, they noticed that a lot of firearms were not being surrendered. So before people served the orders of protection, before law enforcement served them, they researched the offenders, not only for licenses for pistols and firearms, but also to see if that offender had been involved in any other gun-involved situation. So the equivalent in New York State might be they could look at our domestic incident report repository, which lists all of the other domestic incidents in which an individual has been involved, and would note whether or not a gun had been involved. That then means when the officer responds, they're much more informed, which is better for everybody. You may have heard recently, just a couple days ago, two officers were killed, I think, in Ohio, responding to a domestic. They're very dangerous situations for law enforcement officers as well as for victims, obviously. So the more information the law enforcement officers have when they're serving the orders or enforcing the orders, the more likely they can adequately enforce those orders in the first place.
Other than Governor Cuomo's efforts to remove firearms from domestic abusers, what other pieces of legislation regarding domestic abuse are before the legislature right now, and what's their status?
There are always a lot of bills pending, so I'm not going to go through a laundry list, but I think one that's very important addresses, and this is really not domestic violence so much as sexual assault broadly, is it addresses kind of a carve-out for police officers. There's currently a law that says that corrections officers who sexually assault an inmate cannot claim that the inmate consented to that sexual assault, which makes sense, right? If you're incarcerated, you really don't have any power to not consent to behavior. And there's a pending bill that would expand those that description to include all law enforcement officers. So somebody who's under arrest would be deemed unable to consent to activity like that. So I think that's a really important law out there. We're having a national conversation about what consent means. And I think we should all agree that if you have been arrested or incarcerated, you're unable to withhold consent to certain behavior.
That was Executive Director of HER Justice, Amy Barash, speaking with 51%'s Brian Shields. Duluth, Minnesota-based illustrator and author Chris Monroe has just published her fifth Monkey with the Tool Belt children's book, a series featuring a cheeky monkey. She's also the mind behind Violet Days, a comic strip that ran 22 years in the Star Tribune and Duluth News Tribune before being pulled in February 2018. KFAI's Diane Richard reports.
At a bookstore in Edina, Minnesota, I'm Diane Richard, and I'm waiting for story time.
You guys want to listen to this story?
Love to.
It's called Monkey with a Tool Belt and the Silly School Mystery.
Okay.
So this is the book, and I'm the author and the illustrator of this book. Do you guys know what an illustrator does?
Chris Monroe perches on a little chair amid six-year-olds on brightly colored poofs and one middle-aged woman holding a microphone. The Duluth native looks younger than her 50-something years. Maybe that's because she thinks like a kid. She's in the Twin Cities to promote her newest kid's book. It's the fifth in her Monkey with the Tool Belt series.
Chico Bon Bon and Clark were on their way to school. You see what's happening? The watermelon's ripping out of his backpack. Because, you know, everybody has a watermelon in their backpack. Chico wore a special tool belt for school.
Chico Bon Bon has big googly eyes, a long swooping tail, and a suave demeanor. Unlike Curious George, this chimp doesn't need a man in a yellow hat to solve problems.
What kind of lessons does the monkey with the tool belt impart?
Keep calm, use your tools, you know, don't freak out. He's a very calm character, he's very capable, and he can fix anything.
Chico hasn't entered the ranks of popular book characters like Ferdinand and George. Still, he does have fans. Monroe came up with the Fix-It chimp while she was working at a hardware store in Duluth.
And I really thought there was a big gap in characters that were funny and cute that could use tools.
At the reading, the kids' ears clamp onto Monroe's story. One even offers a few plot points from a different book in the series. He knows all of Chico's tricks.
He's trying in the ocean in a big water slide.
And what's he doing over here?
And he's carrying out of a banana.
The end. Thanks, guys, for being such good listeners.
Monroe went to the Minneapolis College of Art and Design to become an illustrator. Since then, she's done books and fine art, but she may be best known for her comic strip, Violet Days. Until recently, it ran weekly in the Star Tribune and the Duluth News Tribune. Violet Days characters look like they mainline caffeine. Monroe uses skinny lines and lots of scratchy text. She focuses on quirky things that pique her curiosity or crack her up, like weird foods, news-making squirrels, an angel figurine on a fence post that kept disappearing, then reappearing.
Do you hear from people who read your strip?
I do. I get kind of a lot of fan mail. And actually, the book signing I did here last week, a whole bunch of Violet Days fans showed up. And they had clipped out comics from the paper over the years, crammed in their books. And they were great.
And this is my fangirl moment to gush.
I have made a point over the last 15, 20 years of always reading Violet Days. Always. It's like the first thing I turn to, which is weird. But I just really like it.
You know, the people that like it really like it a lot.
Maybe we like it because it reminds us of our childhoods, our rosebud moments of angels on fence posts. I threw out a topic I thought might grab her.
What is wassail?
Wassail?
Wassail.
Yeah. Because isn't it, here we come a wassailing? Isn't it like caroling?
Maybe. I kind of thought it was booze.
Yeah, because there's a wassail punch or something, isn't it? Wassail. It's got to be some sort of merriment. I don't really know. That could be my next comic. I'll credit you in that for that.
A week later, I turned to Violet Days in the Star Tribune's variety section. The title was "What Is Wassail?" and in a line-drawn punch bowl were the words, "For Diane." Love and joy come to you, and to you your wassail too, and God bless you and say. For KFAI Radio, I'm Diane Richard.
The New York Botanical Garden has named its first female president. Carrie Rabora Barrett, a career administrator and curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, tells the New York Times she is excited to apply her scholarship and management expertise to the world of plants and landscapes. The Board of Trustees says Barrett will officially take office in July, succeeding CEO and President Gregory Long. Barrett says she was not looking for a new job when she was asked to apply for the garden position last fall, but that her enthusiasm about the garden is hard to resist. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1493.